From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Iowa, you're in the spotlight today. Both President Trump and Joe Biden are in the state. Trump in the western part visiting an ethanol plant and attending a Republican fundraiser. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the front runner in the crowded field of Democratic presidential candidates, will be in the eastern part. And if his prepared remarks are any indication, he will be going on the offensive against the president with lines like, "We can overcome 4 years of Trump, but if we give him 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation." Iowa is an important swing state. We all know that. It holds the first caucus in the country. So let's bring in Clay Masters from Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Robin.
And start with Trump highlighting his administration's new ethanol policy and talking about farm policy in Council Bluffs. You know, this comes as we have the Chinese tariffs. They're hitting farmers. And also we're seeing this flooding throughout the Midwest. You know, first of all, how are Iowans feeling about Trump policy in general?
Well, there certainly Republicans still strongly support the president. And this ethanol policy that he is rolling out and going to be highlighting during this tour of this facility there in Council Bluffs, people have largely been pretty favorable of this rollout. The president lifted restrictions on selling year-round E15. That's a form of gasoline blended with 15% ethanol, which is primarily made with corn. You know, Iowa is the number one corn-producing state. So farmers here see this as a benefit for their corn crops. Industry leaders have praised the rule, saying it fulfills a key campaign promise. And also, I should say, politicians of both major parties have also applauded the move. For example, Democratic Congresswoman Cindy Axne will be at the president's event today where he'll unveil the E15 decision. And Axne defeated a Republican incumbent last year and represents the district where he'll be speaking today.
Yeah, but we know ethanol has at times fallen out of favor. And now we have a lot of corn, maybe not as much in Iowa, but in other parts of the country, underwater. So is there concern there?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly has been concerns because, you know, we've been talking about farmers being hit by the tariffs and also just a very wet year. And there are some negative impacts of this move, or not so much negative impacts of the move itself. But, you know, I brought up Congresswoman Cindy Axne. She said in a statement yesterday that she would be at this event, but also talking about waivers the EPA has been handing out to oil companies, basically allowing oil refiners to avoid blending ethanol and gasoline. And ethanol industry leaders have also been saying that that's destroying demand for ethanol. And that's also what many of the Democrats who want to challenge Trump next year have been saying as they campaign in the state, which leads off this presidential nominating process.
Well, and of course, Joe Biden challenging him today. He's saying things like Trump doesn't get the basics. He thinks his tariffs are being paid by China. Any beginning econ student at Iowa or Iowa State could tell you the American people are paying his tariffs. The cashiers at Target know more about economics than Trump. Is there sentiment there about, you know, how these tariffs have been weaponized?
Yeah, and I should also note that Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, last week in talking with reporters, she was saying that when she meets with the president while he's here, she's going to bring up tariffs and saying that, you know, these are not effective ways when they're trying to ratify what the new trade agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, known as the USMCA. And there are concerns about what tariffs do with exports to China. You know, the Trump administration has doled out billions of dollars to farmers who have been affected by his trade wars because he's trying to, you know, keep support among them. So, yes, that is certainly something that gets talked a lot about here as tariffs and the trade war goes on.
Quick question. Joe Biden did not attend the Iowa Democrats' annual Hall of Fame dinner over the past weekend. 19 other candidates did. He said he didn't because he had his daughter's birthday and his granddaughter's graduation, and people appreciate those family ties. But Iowa is the state he did not win. You know, he only got 1% of the vote in the Iowa caucuses back in 2008 and dropped out of the presidential race after that, went on to become, you know, the candidate for vice president. So how are Iowans feeling about the fact that he didn't show then?
Well, there were 5 minutes for each of the candidates to speak on this weekend event. So, I mean, like, there wasn't a whole lot of time for for them to make their case. And there was some criticism slung his way for not attending. But for the most part, they kept their focus on Trump. And certainly Biden has been here once before. He didn't make that candidate visit or that campaign visit to the Hall of Fame event. But he's back again, and the timing couldn't be better for him because he wants this to already look like a race between him and the president.
And the polls show it is. We got just 30 seconds, Clay. Does he have the appeal, Biden, this is, he needs to defeat Trump if he is the Democratic candidate, that blue-collar appeal?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but certainly there is appeal there. And many of the presidential candidates this cycle have been spending a lot of time barnstorming the state, trying to appeal to rural voters, trying to appeal to the working class voters to make sure that they do show up for them and kind of take back that working class manufacturer base that they want to show up on caucus night.
Yeah. Clay Masters from Iowa Public Radio. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
The race is on for the next Prime Minister of Britain. There are 10 candidates in the running for the job as leader of Britain's Conservative Party. That job has been held by Theresa May. She stepped aside after failing three times to get her plan for Brexit through Parliament. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson knows about everything Brexit, the UK's plan to exit from the European Union. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. They call me Mr. Brexit. And sometimes when I come into the BBC, people look at me as if they think, oh, my God, there's that poor bloke who's got Brexit, like it was some kind of disease.
Well, we're happy to be part of your contagion. So just to be clear, the Conservative Party rules in Britain. So whoever becomes the leader of the Conservative Party becomes the prime minister. That's what's going on here. And the party is still really divided over whether Britain should even pull out of the EU. And that's kind of demonstrated by the people who are in the running for leader.
That's absolutely right. I mean, a lot of people listening are going to think this is kind of crazy. What? So in a country of 45 million eligible voters, only the 120,000 or so members of the Conservative Party decides next prime minister. But absolutely, them's the rules. And so you've just sort of got to get on with it. On your point, I would say this briefly. You kind of wonder why on earth it is so many contenders are vying for this job, because it does look like the most poisoned of poison chalices. As you say, the governing Conservative Party is deeply split about what to do about the EU. And number two, that the country itself is even more divided than it was at the time of the referendum. I think the rest of the world, perhaps Donald Trump excepted, has sort of already made up its mind that Brexit is a mistake. So whoever takes over is really going to have an uphill battle.
By the way, what are the US interests in this?
That is a very interesting question. I mean, the president overturning sort of 60 years of U.S. foreign policy, which had always been in favor of a united Europe through NATO, through the European Union, with Britain its number one European ally at the heart of that. I mean, Donald Trump has sort of torn all that up. Apart from that, I mean, I suspect the U.S. interest is that the U.K. should remain a sort of stable and reliable partner, stable in terms of the economic interest, but also as a security partner.
And tell us in terms of the candidates, I don't know if the United States would have a preference among the many candidates right now who are in the running. Tell us about some of the top ones.
Right. Well, the absolute out-and-out clear favourite is also the president's favourite, and that is Boris Johnson. I guess what would I say about the candidates? They range from those who are super enthusiastic Brexiteers like Mr. Johnson, who just sort of can't wait to get on with Brexit, even if there's no deal, through to those candidates who say, no, look, it would just be preposterous to leave without a deal. The consequences would be so terrible. But here's the thing. For those like Mr. Johnson who say, well, let's just leave without a deal if we can't get one, I mean, people like Mr. Johnson have yet to explain how you would sort of deal with the dire economic fallout predicted by the government itself of a no-deal Brexit, whereas those who say, yeah, look, I'm just going to get a better deal than Theresa May got with the European Union, they've yet to explain how they would do that.
Has anybody, when you talk about the dire economic consequences of the UK pulling out of the EU, have any of the candidates actually explained how they would deal with this?
They just disagree with the premises. So those who back Brexit and those who back the idea of leaving the European Union, even if that means leaving without a deal, they just dispute the idea that it would be that much of an economic catastrophe. I'm only citing, however, the government's own figures, which suggest that all forms of Brexit, no matter how distant or close Britain remains to the European Union, all of them would be bad for the economy. It's just that the no deal would be worse. But candidates like Boris Johnson, they just dismiss that.
Who are the other candidates who have a chance?
The other two favorites, although they're all trailing behind, is a man called Jeremy Hunt. He's currently the foreign secretary, and he was a Remainer, but he's now an enthusiastic Brexiteer. But here's what I would say. While Mr. Johnson is the favorite, I just think this race is going to be so brutal that it just makes it immensely unpredictable. I mean, you can't help thinking in such fraught circumstances. MPs are angry, they're exhausted. I mean, you know, we are in the middle of a crisis in this country, and this leadership election is being decided amidst an atmosphere of crisis. And that, I think, is why the race is somewhat unpredictable.
It's a crisis within Parliament, kind of out on the streets and with the civilian population. Does it feel like a crisis there as well?
People may not be out on the streets, but there's no doubt that Brexit has divided Britain in a way that nothing else has happened, certainly in my 30-odd years as a reporter. And I don't really think since the end of the Second World War, because normally in the past in Britain, politics was divided on a sort of left-right basis. We now have a division which is maybe more familiar to Americans, where it's a division on the basis of identity, culture, how you think of yourself, how you think of Britain and its place in the world. And so whoever takes over from Theresa May, my goodness, they've got a job of healing to do.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson speaking to us from London. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave, own your temperature.
CNN reporter Jim Acosta is out with a new book, and the title is The Slur President Trump Uses Against Members of the Press, particularly Acosta. Enemy of the people is also, of course, the phrase Soviet and Nazi leaders used against those they disagreed with and ordered arrested. The Trump administration has only tried to take Acosta's microphone away, as in this press briefing when an intern tried to grab it from him.
That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President,
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
That ended with the White House revoking Acosta's credentials, which a judge decided they could not do. Jim Acosta says he never wanted to be the story, but now from the front lines of what he calls a war on all but the right-wing media, he's writing it in this new book, Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America, asking and answering questions like, is he making a mistake by taking the president's bait? Jim Acosta joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's get right to that main question you are often asked. Do you feel you are taking the bait, that the president has, you know, laid some of this bait out for you and turned you into his foil to the thrill of his base?
Well, I think we can't avoid covering the news. And, you know, when the president says something like, you know, you're the enemy of the people, I think I'm well within my right to stand up and say, you know, this is well within my lane as a journalist and as an American to say that that's not appropriate. We should not have the president of the United States referring to segments of American society as the enemy of the people. Mm-hmm. And I'll take you back to the press conference at Trump Tower after the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, when I asked him a question and I said, Mr. President, the neo-Nazis started this down in Charlottesville. And he proceeded to say, well, there were very fine people on both sides. And at that point, I interjected and I said, there are no fine people in the Nazis. I didn't put those comments in the form of a question because I didn't think I needed to. They are bad people. So there have been times where, yes, the president and I have tangled with one another. But in each and every one of those instances, I feel as though I've been trying to not just report the news, but stand up for the truth.
Well, you write of that moment when the president made that comment about fine people on both sides. You said there are moments like that when the president permanently damaged his presidency. But then we saw, you know, white supremacist Richard Spencer have that meeting in Washington and, you know, give Trump the Nazi salute and not a dent.
Well, no, I think his presidency has been dented. It's been damaged by some of these episodes, and it was the Charlottesville episode where, you know, I came to the conclusion that when you're reporting the news and reporting on this presidency, that there aren't two sides to a story when it's a matter of right versus wrong. When the president of the United States equivocates over white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, you have to essentially call it like you see it.
Well, but what about the image that's projected? We remember the study that was done when President Reagan wasn't doing very well. I think he was actually a candidate at this point. And his handlers decided to surround him with American flags. And what he was saying was actually not registering well, but focus groups showed that people didn't see that. They saw the flags. What people, American people, are seeing and what the White House is claiming is that there's a press corps beating up on him, almost victimizing the president. How do you overcome that image?
First of all, you know, as I write in the book, we've been thrust into an unprecedented situation. We've had presidents come and we've had presidents go from both parties, and they've gotten frustrated with our coverage from time to time. But they've never taken their frustration to this extent, where they're referring to us as fake news and the enemy of the people.
You are quick to point out that other presidents also bend the truth to meet their political needs. Clinton's,
but,
you know, depending on what the meaning of is, you say the Obama people could. Yes.
Yeah, but not to this extent. As the Washington Post discovered recently and laid out, the president has made approximately 10,000 false or misleading statements since the beginning of his presidency. And my goodness, what would be our sense of the truth and reality these days if we hadn't fact-checked this president in real time? And that's what we've had to do as journalists. I think back, and I write about this in the book, about my father's experience being a Cuban refugee and fleeing Cuba for the United States 3 weeks before the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, his experience has always given me an appreciation for the freedoms that we have in this country, such as freedom of expression, such as a free press. And when I went to Cuba in 2016, I had a chance to ask Raul Castro a question. You know, why do you have political prisoners? Why don't you let them go? A Cuban reporter can't get away with something like that, but a Cuban American can. That has been an asset to the American people. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book is I want folks to think, you know, deeply about where we are right now. And do we want to have the federal government, which is the president of the United States, is the federal government, referring to journalists as the enemy?
You mentioned the president using the phrase fake news. Let's listen.
Over the course
of— just sit down, please. Well, when you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
Mr. President.
So there he is accusing you of reporting fake news, a phrase that he told Leslie Stahl, according to Leslie Stahl, he uses just to poison that well. The well is poisoned, though. I mean, a huge percentage of Republicans in particular do not believe news accounts outside of right-wing news outlets.
Right. And what I talk about in the book is we've got to get back to a place where we have a little more faith in one another. We can't have Trump supporters only trust what comes out of conservative news media and vice versa. And, you know, one of the things that I let the reader in on is what's been going on behind the scenes. You know, on the same day that the president called me very fake news at a press conference in February of 2017, his top aide, Hope Hicks, called me on the phone and said, you know, Jim, I just want you to know the president thinks you acted very professionally today. And he says, Jim gets it. Okay, if the president is so steamed at me and he thinks I'm fake news, why is his top aide calling me and saying that the president thought I did a good job today? What I've found in writing this book is that this started off as an act, a continuation of his reality TV style bluster that we saw on the campaign trail, and it's gotten out of control. Many of his supporters, not all of them, a lot of those folks are wonderful people, but some of them have absorbed that rhetoric and then directed it at us in ways that have made us feel endangered. I've received death threats. My colleagues have received death threats. I just want folks to be aware of this so we can think about this and say, geez, do we want this to be how things go for the next couple of generations?
Look, I am just parroting back to you the same questions you asked yourself over the course of the book, which is, am I taking the bait too much? And here's why I am taking the bait if I'm taking the bait. You just said that this, quote, reality show got out of hand for the president. To some, it feels as if it might have gotten out of hand for some of the reporters as well, because you are inadvertently in somebody else's show. I was just reading The Guardian this morning in their review of your book, and they write, lest Acosta forget, Edward R. Murrow's takedown of Joe McCarthy, Walter Cronkite's editorial on the Vietnam War carried sway because they both had such gravitas and credibility and respected boundaries and lines. Do you worry about losing that gravitas because you're having to respond to somebody who often doesn't have it?
I'm just there to do my job on a regular basis and try to ask the tough questions of people who are in power. And as The Guardian notes, Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam and came back and said, this war cannot be won. And LBJ at that point said, well, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. So there have been times when members of the press have perhaps stepped out of that traditional lane of just being straight, objective, right down the middle of news reporting and have offered observations and analysis that have been critical at important moments in our history. We aren't just here to call balls and strikes. Sometimes we have to call fouls, and sometimes we have to deliver to the American people painful truths.
One last quick question, and I already know the answer, but I feel I have to ask it anyway. You mentioned your father, who left Cuba when he was 11. He's much like the Dreamers. It seems like your moral compass. And a part of your outrage at the way immigrants are being discussed in this country. But does that also raise another question? Is this maybe too personal for you? Is there a point at which Jim Acosta might say, you know what, I'm not the guy to be doing this because it's become too personal between me and the president and too personal because of my personal feelings?
Not at all. And as I write in the book, you know, there was that confrontation that I had with Stephen Miller, one of the president's top domestic policy advisors and an architect of much of his immigration policy over at the White House. You know, we got into a back and forth over the Statue of Liberty and what it means to this country. And Miller tried to say that the Statue of Liberty is not a symbol to immigrants coming to our shores. And I said to him that day that that was National Park revisionism. I mean, when my dad came to this country, he and other Cuban Americans that were making a life here were not referred to as rapists and killers and criminals. My dad tells me the story about how a Presbyterian church provided them with coats and sweaters so they could be warm during their first winter. That has been, in my view, what has been best about America, when we are welcoming to people of all walks of life coming to our country, not open borders as the anti-immigration zealots describe it. And so I feel I'm well within my lane as a straight news reporter to say you can't rewrite our nation's history and say that the Statue of Liberty doesn't represent the best of America, that it doesn't represent our immigrant story.
I'm reminded, too, that Murrow said of McCarthy, this is no time for men who oppose him to keep silent or for those who approve.
We have to speak truth to power. Yeah. That's why we're here.
CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta, his new book, Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Jim Acosta, thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Apple's manufacturing partner in China, Foxconn, announced this week it has the capacity to make iPhones outside China if the U.S.-China trade war intensifies. One wrinkle in the company's plan may be the issue of what are called rare earth metals. Rare earths are 17 chemical elements used in everything from electric vehicles to glass, and China mines the minerals and processes the lion's share of them. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Lisa.
So U.S. industries need rare earth metals and imports 80% of them from China. So China is warning at this time that it may cut off that supply as part of the trade war with the U.S. What are these rare earth metals?
Well, first of all, they're not as rare as we think. It's just that they're hard to mine. We certainly haven't developed the capacity to do so in the United States. So we are really dependent either on getting them from China or processing them in China.
But which is hugely polluting.
That's right. So they are, as you said, 17 different metallic elements, and they're essential parts to many, many high-tech devices. They're in high-tech consumer products like every cell phone, computer hard drives, electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, flat-screen monitors. They're used in the processing of oil, and they're used in a lot of military applications as well, like guidance systems, displays, lasers, radar, sonar systems. So they're they're crucial to our technological existence.
Apple itself uses no fewer than 8 rare earth metals in its iPhone. Raytheon uses them for missile guidance systems. Do these companies and others have anywhere else to turn for metals aside from China?
The answer is sort of. There's actually one mine in the United States that harvests rare earth minerals. It's in Mountain Pass, California. In fact, even Mountain Pass takes its rare earth minerals, sends them to China for processing, and then they come back to the United States. However, because of things that the world is concerned about and because of something that China's done in the past, their production of rare earth minerals has gone from about 97% of all of rare earth minerals used in 2010 to about 71% last year. So we're actually trying to minimize the impact that China has on rare earth minerals. However, again, as I say, we produce some in the United States, but we ship it to China to be processed.
And this is not the first time China's threatened to cut its supply of rare earth metals. It followed through back in 2010 when a Chinese trawler collided with two of Japan's Coast Guard ships in the East China Sea. What happened then?
So that was actually the incident that caused a lot of the world to start thinking about new alternatives to Chinese rare earth. The suspension of Chinese shipments lasted only 7 weeks, and in fact, it didn't seem to affect Japanese imports of Chinese rare earth minerals after that. However, China made an announcement at the time that China doesn't want to use rare earth minerals as a bargaining tool because the world is so reliant on them for this. And by cutting off those imports for a while, the exports for a while, the price went up, which caused others to start to think about mining and processing rare earth minerals. So that contributed to the drop from about 97% of rare earth minerals in 2010 down to about 70% today.
Allie, how big a concern is this for U.S. tech and defense firms?
It's very serious. They are really thinking about workarounds. Workarounds can exist. One of the things they're thinking about is the amount of stuff that uses rare earth minerals that are discarded because they're such pollutants. What if we then started taking those out of those pieces of equipment and recycling it. So there's a lot of thought about how this actually gets fixed.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks again.
Thanks, Lisa.
A personal note, I was lucky once to visit Machu Picchu, the ancient Incan ruins in Peru, with Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Stan Grossfeld during the harmonic convergence, that once-in-a-lifetime planetary alignment that was supposed to bring spiritual energy. We hiked and camped with Peruvian guides through terraced lands. It took a week to get there. Once there, dawn broke and an odd noise broke the stillness. Radios blasting from buses making their way up the road, loaded with tourists who'd made a more simple several-hour trip from the nearest city, demanding to see the harmonic convergence. Our solitude was broken. But much more may be endangered when tourists are able to fly in. Construction is underway on a new international airport, and opponents say it will disturb important archaeological sites in the area known as Peru's Sacred Valley. Abel Traslavina is a Peruvian archaeologist and PhD student at Vanderbilt University, one of nearly 50,000 people who signed an online petition protesting this new airport. He joins us from Peru. Abel, I remember hiking. You'd go past what looked like ancient huts with people herding their sheep. Describe that area for us.
Yeah, it's the hinterland. I mean, it's the center of the empire, the Inca Empire. So all the surroundings of the city of Cusco are, you know, full of terraces. We call it estancias. It's like shacks, we can say, or little houses in the high areas. For the pasture, for the llamas, for example. I mean, they're moving all over.
Well, your point is what we think we saw. These are herders. And so it's not as if they're, you know, staying on one piece of farmland. They are moving around the entire area. It's all connected. It's connected by these terraces, these little huts along the way that as a hiker you can stay in, but that's where the herders stay because it's permeable. There's no boundaries. But into the middle of this is a proposal for this airport. The art historian behind the online petition that you signed wrote, "The airport endangers the conservation of one of the most important historical and archaeological sites in the world." Outside of this, broader landscape that's all interconnected. What other archaeological sites are you worried about?
Well, those terraces are archaeological.
Yes, yes.
And they're connected by roads. The royal road named Kapagnan, it's not a site protected by UNESCO, but it's like a massive landscape, we can say. Mm-hmm. And from the technical report from the Ministry of Culture, there are at least four paths or four roads, crossing that area. But they didn't take into account this evidence. Mm. But also the fields, the terraces, or even the lagoons, even they're like an association of weavers, women, they're going to be impacted by this airport, all the small businesses and everything like that.
Two things. Right now, most of the 1 million people who visit Machu Picchu every year, most of them fly into Cuzco. This new airport could relieve strain on that city, reduce overcrowding in Cuzco. And also, this airport might enable, more people to come and see this historically rich site and have a greater understanding of both it and of Peru. Mm-hmm. It could be better for Peru. Isn't that true, that this would enable more people who wouldn't be able to come and see it?
Yeah, I understand the idea, but this is an international airport. Cuzco Airport, the current one, it's a national, it's a local airport. So, it is crowded not because of a natural functioning of the airport. It's crowded because the planning from the government is not well done. For example, we don't have a totally paved roads in that area. We have some, but still, because of the rainy season every year, all the mudslides, it's not totally planned. Mm. They didn't say anything about how this airport is connected to all the communities around, or even Machu Picchu, or having better roads or something like that. It's just about the airport, and we don't know why they are obsessed with this idea.
Well, and you're saying that they're plopping down an airport without talking about the ripple effect that will have and their plans for addressing those effects. That's Abel Traslavinia, mm-hmm. a Peruvian archaeologist and PhD student in Vanderbilt University's Department of Anthropology, one of 50,000 people who signed a petition calling on the government of Peru to please not build an airport near Machu Picchu, but construction has already started.
Yeah.
Abel, one last thought. Have you lost?
Yeah, it's sad for all of us. Not just for the people who signed the petition. For example, El Comercio, which is the main newspaper here in Peru, they were collecting, opinions from both sides. And one of them was the owner of a famous hotel here in Peru, Casa Andina. And he said, Peru is in baby steps in terms of tourism. I don't understand that, because right now, Machu Picchu has like 1,500 people a day. Is that baby steps?
Mm. Abel, you've been terrific in speaking about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me.
Well, now to North Carolina, where for years researchers have been fascinated by a swamp, or more specifically, the trees that grow there. Decades ago, they identified dozens of bald cypress trees they believed were part of an ancient forest. But they weren't sure exactly how ancient, how long these trees have been in this remote corner of the state until recently. Will Michaels of WUNC reports.
This is the Black River in southeastern North Carolina. It's an eerily calm, dark river with the roots of thousands of tall cypress trees popping through the surface of the water like stalagmites in a cave. And it's really in the middle of nowhere.
There was just an alligator right here where we're paddling last week when we were out here.
Angie Carl manages this part of the river for the Nature Conservancy, an environmental group that recently bought the land around the swamp. We kayak to a cypress forest in this coastal blackwater swamp. The water is almost totally still, but it's impossible to see beyond the surface.
It looks like sweet tea. All the needles bleach and leaves bleach into the water and turn it a reddish color.
Downriver, the dense, smaller trees open into a clearing. Suddenly, they get much bigger.
You can look up now and see ancient
tops coming up on the left. And this tree right here, look how big the buttress is when you look up and it's broken off, but it's still growing.
Carl weaves our kayak through more roots and stops at the bottom of a thick cypress about 60 feet tall, sitting in a few feet of water. David Staley floats up next to us.
Well, we're underneath one of the multi-millennial-aged bald cypress trees at Black River, North Carolina.
Staley is a geosciences professor at the University of Arkansas and the lead author of a new study about these trees. Staley used radiocarbon dating, took a core sample, and counted the rings in this tree.
It's at least 2,624 years old, so the inner ring is 605 BC. That's amazing.
The report in the journal Environmental Research Communications identifies this cypress as the fifth oldest living tree in the world.
And he looks old. I mean, he's got busted out canopy. He's resprouted smaller limbs to survive. He's got areas where the big heavy branches have been ripped out and soil has accumulated. And he has a little garden of geraniums growing out of the side of a busted out hollow.
What makes this discovery more surprising is that it's in the hot and humid wetlands of coastal North Carolina. The oldest trees on record are in dry, temperate places like Nevada and California. But Staley says the cypress can tolerate the harsher conditions of the Carolinas.
We think it has to do with this nutrient-poor, acidic swamp water conditions. So the trees grow slowly and achieve remarkable age. All of those things contribute to the exclusion of most competing tree species.
Staley studies trees like these to get a better idea of climate history. Each ring of the tree's core represents a growing season, and tiny variations give researchers an estimate of each year's rainfall. That's more than 2,000 years of data that can show what's natural when it comes to droughts and floods and how humans are disrupting that. Angie Carl paddles back upriver.
Start counting the millennial age trees, and you can tell which ones they are. They're all around us.
The Black River is a navigation channel, but it's hard to access and not fully open to the public. She says she hopes it will be one day.
What did someone call it? The Sistine Chapel of the Cypress Swamps? And it is.
Except it has about 2,000 years on Michelangelo. For Here and Now, I'm Will Michaels.
Calls for regulation on technology giants have reached a fever pitch. They come after reports that the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department's Antitrust Division will look into companies including Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple. Let's go now to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is Recode's editor-at-large. Hi, Kara.
How you doing?
Good. Kara, you recently wrote in the New York Times, the tech lash has officially arrived. Now, you'd think you'd be happy about this because you've long been critical of these tech companies and called for more accountability, but you write that you are not thrilled with these calls for regulation. How come?
Well, no, I'm thrilled that the idea that regulators are going to move in, because this is an industry that's long past due date on getting some regulatory oversight and guardrails in place. What I'm worried about is the sudden obsession with breaking them up or doing not being thoughtful about what we're doing here. Now, every major industry does get some sort of regulation. And what I'd like to have is smart regulation, thoughtful regulation, and appropriate regulation. And so I'm a little worried when I hear every candidate saying sort of just mouthing pretty superficial lines rather than some really thoughtful and creative ways to keep this innovative industry innovative and at the same time put in important safeguards for users and others.
You say the very same agencies and legislators now screaming for blood have for decades ignored any sensible regulation of Silicon Valley, afraid of killing the golden geeks. Nice turn of phrase, by the way. When you say that they seem to be in the dark, what do you mean? Point to something.
Well, they've spent a lot of time. Like what I did, I found an essay I wrote 10 years ago about Google when they were trying to get control of Yahoo search, and they sort of took a dive on it. They constantly, whatever administration it is, the FTC had not acted at all in any way for a decade or more. And as these problems started to mount, and I think if they had done something earlier, we wouldn't have these social media problems we have. We wouldn't have this election interference problems. And we would have had a group of people much more cognizant that there are repercussions to actions.
So what is the correct way of doing this in your view?
Well, there's a lot of ways. It depends on the company, right? Is perhaps antitrust, at least the discussion of antitrust is appropriate for a Facebook or a Google. It probably isn't for an Apple. There may be some regulatory things you can do about pricing around the App Store, for example. You know, Amazon's a really interesting case. It isn't the biggest retailer by stretch by the numbers, but at the same time, it dominates online commerce. How do you best create a situation where competitors can thrive and these big giant companies don't suck up all the oxygen? It's a really important discussion that we need to have because tech is one of our most important industries that we have. And at the same time, we can't, you know, allow these big companies to make major societal decisions for us that have impact on all its citizens. There's issues around privacy, there's issues around addiction, there's issues around the ability of these companies to run to one person to have complete control. It's the way the stock is done. So there's all kinds of ways to get at this. And I just want each one to, it shouldn't be just a big giant hammer. It should be much more subtle, like surgery.
I wonder if you can talk about what President Trump has said. Let's listen to him on CNBC's Squawk Box yesterday, talking about fines and lawsuits against American tech companies in the European Union.
Well, we should be doing, they're our companies. So they're actually attacking our companies, but we should be doing what they're doing. They think that there's a monopoly, but I'm not sure that they think that. They just figure this is easy money. We'll sue Apple for $7 billion and we'll make a settlement or we'll win the case. So I think it's a bad situation, but obviously there is something going on in terms of monopoly.
He says there is something going on in terms of monopoly with American tech companies, Kara?
He doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm sorry. He's completely. This is typical. This is what I'm talking about. It's just errant discussions without any knowledge of the situation. I think, you know, what's interesting about Trump is because he does attack the tech companies quite a bit, is that he's directionally correct and completely wrong on the facts, which is kind of a problem. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Directionally correct. Yes, these are powerful companies that need to be scrutinized more than they have been by the government. At the same time, saying these things is incredibly careless. Wait, and that's exactly the problem.
So an example where he's wrong?
He just doesn't like they just are trying to get fined so the getting's good. No, the European Union is being very thoughtful about taxes and things like that. They may be doing too much. A lot of people feel they are. It's just you can say something that's correct, but how to get at it and how to keep it as a being more nuanced and subtle is really hard. I just interviewed Stacey Abrams last night, who ran for governor of Georgia. She had a very nuanced argument about the tech companies, and that's the kind of thinking we want to have about what should be done, and thoughtful and nuanced, and here's what'll work, here's one, working with all the stakeholders, including citizens, the companies, and government to keep this industry thriving, and at the same time, you know, not letting them have unlimited power. It's a very delicate thing to do correctly. And just loud speeches like Trump just did are just, it's not helpful in any way.
One more thing, you're at the Code Conference today. There's been a lot of talk about YouTube. The video site's CEO was on stage yesterday answering questions about the ongoing efforts to crack down on hate speech and extremism on YouTube. How serious are their efforts in your view?
Well, we also have the some of the top executives from Twitter and other and Facebook, and I think a lot of them are in the mode of, well, we've made mistakes, we better fix them, and maybe it's a little hard for us to do so. So I don't think everyone was very happy with it, but at the same time, at least they're in those discussion modes, so that's always a plus.
That's Kara Swisher, editor at large for Recode. Kara, nice to talk to you as always.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.